ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 30, Text 29, Chapter of the Gopis Search for Krishna. Danya aho ami alyo, Govindan grabja rainava, Govindan grabja rainava, Yan Brahmeshau Rama Devi Dadhur Murd Yagha Munutaye Dadhur Murd Yagha Nutaye Danya Aho Ami Alyo Govindan Grabja Renava Yan Brahmeshau Rama Devi Dadhur Murd Yagham Nutaye Danya Aho Ami Alyo Govindang Gribja Rainhava Yan Brahmeshau Rama Devi Dadhur Murd Yaghanutaye Ladies. Danya, sanctified. Aho, ah. Okay, ah, yeah, okay, ah. Trying to figure out that's unusual. Okay. Ami, these. Alya, O gopis. Govinda, O of Govinda. Angri abja, of the lotus-like feet. Rainava. The particles of dust. Yan, which? Brahma, Lord Brahma. Yishao, and Lord Shiva. Rama, Devi. Rama Devi, the wife of Lord Vishnu. Dadhu, take. Murdhni, on their heads. Agha, of their sinful reactions. Nutaye, for the dispelling. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. O girls, the dust of Govinda's lotus feet is so sacred that even Brahma, Shiva, and the goddess Rama take that dust upon their heads to dispel sinful reactions. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, who quotes from Shastra, each day in the late afternoon, as Krishna returned from the cow pastures with his coward boyfriends, great demigods like Brahma and Shiva would come down from heaven and take the dust of his feet. Great personalities like the goddess Rama, the wife of Vishnu, Shiva and Brahma are not at all sinful, but in the ecstasy of pure Krishna consciousness, they feel themselves fallen and impure. Thus, desiring to purify themselves, they blissfully take the dust of the Lord's lotus feet on their heads. Om Gyanatimanandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshurmitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpatrubhischa Kripasindubhebhicha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnabhebhyo Namo Namaha. So, very happy to be here in Dallas. We usually were here for the Temple President's GBC meetings, but we missed this year being in Houston, so it's nice to have an opportunity to come here. And for those of you who may not know, we're doing two seminars here. We'll be doing tonight a seminar called Pick Your Partner, which is meant mainly for younger people or people who are in the process of looking for a life mate and entering into the Grihastha Ashram. And Saturday and Sunday all day, we'll have a seminar based upon the PrEP program, which is about basically communication and relationships meant for couples. So that's why we're here. And but it was also a very, very wonderful opportunity to take the darshan of Sri Radha Kalachanji and have the association of all the wonderful devotees here in Dallas. So thank you so much for having us here. Yesterday, apparently, I wasn't here, but it looks like you read about Radharani's lotus feet. We have a long description here in the purport of the markings on the lotus feet of Radharani. And today we're talking about Krishna's lotus feet. So it's interesting because this expression of taking the dust of the lotus feet is one that is found throughout our literature. I just was doing a search on this in the Veda base today, and there were 1,684 references under dust of the lotus feet. So it's certainly something that we talk about a lot and mention. And so this is, it's somewhat of a metaphorical expression, but it's also a literal expression. I mean, here we're talking about devotees who are literally wanting to take the dust that Krishna has walked upon in Vrindavan, that very dust, and of course relish that dust, put it on their heads like that. So in a very literal sense, yes, the dust of Krishna's lotus feet is very, very special to the devotees. But it's also meant in a sense of surrender and service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Krishna's lotus feet are revered, and especially within the Srimad Bhagavatam, by the many, many devotees of the Lord, really for two reasons, probably more, but two that I could see. One is that they purify, they give great relief from suffering, they relieve one from sin, taking the dust of that lotus feet. And secondly, they just give great transcendental pleasure to the devotees, very much relishable, the feet of the Lord and the dust that is on those feet of the Lord. In the Bhagavatam 3:16-17, these two are mentioned. Krishna says, "My lotus feet have become so sacred that they immediately wipe out all sin, and they've acquired such a disposition that the goddess of fortune does not leave me." So again, mentioning that not only are sins relieved by contact with Krishna's lotus feet, but they're very, very relishable, especially by the goddess of fortune. When Krishna, of course, in couple chapters. When was it? I'm not sure which chapter the killing of the Kaliya serpent was. I think it was several chapters ago, probably 16, somewhere in that area. One of the unique features of Krishna's killing of Kaliya was that he danced on his head. And therefore, Kaliya got the great benediction of Krishna's lotus feet directly upon his head. And of course, he surrenders in that way as he's defeated by Krishna. And then there's some very nice prayers by the wives, the Nagapatnis, and one of them they say, "O Lord, although this Kaliya, the king of the serpents, has taken birth in the mode of ignorance and is controlled by anger, he has achieved that which is difficult for others to achieve. Embodied souls who are full of desires and are thus wandering in the cycle of birth and death can have all benedictions manifested before their eyes simply by receiving the dust of your lotus feet." So again, the wives of Kaliya are recognizing this great benediction that he has had of having Krishna's feet directly on his head. Now, Brahma, Shiva, and Lakshmi are also wanting this. It's stated in this verse that they have great desire to take this dust upon their head. In fact, it says that they come down from the heavenly planets every day when Krishna is returning from the pasturing grounds to be able to receive this benediction. And it's mentioned here that, of course, they are not sinful. These are great devotees. Actually, Brahma, Shiva, Lakshmi are all the heads of our Vaishnava Sampradayas. They are our greatest devotees, our greatest exemplars of devotional service. So it's not so much that they necessarily need purification. They are already pure devotees. But because they are in that position of pure devotional service, they feel themselves very meek and humble, very fallen. And of course, we know, especially in chapter 13 and 14, the pastime of Lord Brahma stealing the cows and calves, then of course being completely defeated by Krishna's mystic power, and then in chapter 14 gives such wonderful prayers. And he expresses this over and over again, how he realizes that he had become puffed up by his great power in being able to actually create the entire material world. But he saw that his power was insignificant compared to Krishna's. So one thing is the humble position the devotee takes. It's not artificial. It's not like it's a good thing to be humble and therefore we feel humble towards Krishna. It's a reality. And Brahma experienced that reality, that next to Krishna, he was nothing. That next to Krishna's power, his power was insignificant. And therefore, there's a natural feeling of humility the more one understands the position of Krishna, the more one understands the greatness of Krishna, the power of Krishna, and how he really is in control of all material and spiritual worlds. So from that position of knowledge of Krishna's position, the devotee is naturally very, very humble. So therefore, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, or Lakshmi, they do feel very humble in the presence of Krishna. And they're very much in this mood of wanting to take shelter of Krishna. But they're also in this mood of very much appreciating Krishna and Krishna's beauty, Krishna's all the wonderful features of Krishna. And therefore, they're relishing this relationship with Krishna. So, we use this expression, the dust of the lotus feet, many, many times. I was thinking that for a new person, if we had a new person in the class today who was just visiting, they might think, what does this mean? What is this dust of lotus feet? Because it's really not something that, especially in the Western world, we're so familiar with. It wouldn't be so meaningful outside of the context of Krishna consciousness. So I was thinking, why do we use this expression? And why is it that Krishna's feet are so relishable to the devotees? Of course, in the material world, the feet are considered the lowest. They're the lowest part of the body. They walk on the ground. They become dirty. They become contaminated. When we go into a house or build, usually we remove our shoes, unless it's a public building or something, because the shoes are dirty. Our feet are dirty. Often, especially not so much here, but especially in India, people will wash their feet before they enter a temple, sometimes even before they enter a house. They wash their feet. So in the material world, it is considered to be a low and dirty part of the body. In fact, we avoid people touching our feet, and we consider it offensive. In other words, if I'm walking and I touch you with my feet, I would consider that an offensive thing for me to do, that I would say, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me for touching you with my feet. So that's the normal approach that we have within this material world. But of course, we know that what is often lowest in the material world is highest in the spiritual world and vice versa. As we have the example in 15.1 in the Bhagavatam of the banyan tree. I'm sorry, of the Bhagavad Gita, of the banyan tree. And Prabhupada explains in that... Need a little more volume? Prabhupada explains in that purport that the material world is considered a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. So we see that in this verse, the banyan tree has its roots growing upward and branches going downward. It's more or less opposite. But Prabhupada says that we can see that if we see a reflection in the water. So if you saw the tree reflected in the water, it would be reversed. So he said it's the same, very similar analogy to the spiritual and material world. The material world is very much like the spiritual world in many ways. It's a reflection of it, but everything is reversed. So things that are very high become very low. Just like we see that this relationship that we're reading about now in these wonderful chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam about the gopis and the gopis now searching for Krishna, and the gopis expressing the very highest essence of spiritual love. Often we see in the material world, sexual relationships between boys and girls, men and women, is not so elevated. In fact, often it's very degraded. And that tends to take us away from spiritual life and be a negative influence. But in the spiritual world, we are seen here in relationship to Krishna, it is the highest. So while our feet may be the lowest part of the body, for those of us in material bodies, for Krishna, it is the most relishable. And of course, we also feel that we can take shelter of those lotus feet. Of course, Krishna's lotus feet are nothing. Why are they called lotus feet? Well, they're nothing like our feet. They are very soft. They are very beautiful. They are very fragrant. There's different expressions given. It was one place in the Bhagavatam that compared to saffron smelling. And of course, we have the example of a lotus. A lotus, very fragrant, very, very, very soft petals. So we can see that just from the sensory perspective, Krishna's feet are very, very wonderful and very relishable. And so therefore, the devotees feel very, very much attracted to them. The other thing is that it's also a sense of service and submission. In other words, even when we approach the deity, we approach the feet. We touch the feet, not the other part of the body. In fact, even when we look upon the deity, we should first look at Krishna's feet and then go up and see all the way to his wonderful smiling face. But it's always good to focus on the feet first, and that more or less preserves our understanding of our position as humble servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, it's also of interest, of course, and should be mentioned that we also talk about the lotus feet of the great devotees and the Vaishnavas. This is mentioned throughout the Bhagavatam as well, that not only do we recognize Krishna's lotus feet, but the lotus feet of the great devotees. Prahlad Maharaj in the seventh canto said, "Unless they smear upon their bodies the dust of the lotus feet of the Vaishnava, completely freed from material contaminations, persons very much inclined toward materialistic life cannot be attached to the lotus feet of the Lord, who is glorified for his uncommon activities. Only by becoming Krishna conscious and taking shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord, in this way one can become free from material contamination." So, Prahlad is saying that we want to attain the lotus feet of Krishna, but we do so by approaching the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas. And of course, that's our process. We don't go directly to Krishna. We go to Krishna through our guru, through the spiritual master. Through the spiritual master's lotus feet and attaining shelter of them through service, that is the way that we will attain Krishna. So, as I was saying, that the lotus feet represents to us the mood of surrender and the mood of service and the mood of taking shelter. This expression is also often used in the Bhagavatam, taking shelter of the lotus feet. So I want to just talk a little bit about that as far as what that means, that we take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. We know that in Krishna consciousness, our goal is to completely surrender to Krishna, to obtain the position of pure, of becoming pure. A pure devotee means one who is purely surrendered to Krishna, one who thinks of Krishna 24 hours a day, is always hearing and chanting about Krishna, always eager to serve Krishna, and also one who very much takes shelter of Krishna at every moment. So we can understand this very easily, theoretically, but sometimes it's, of course, for what does it mean as us for devotees to actually take shelter? This is something that we have to practically realize as we advance in Krishna consciousness. Of course, the six symptoms of surrender are given to us from the Hari Bhakta Vilas, also quoted in Majjhalila 22.100. Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam Vashishatita Vishvasho Gopritve Varanam Tata Atma Nikshepa Karpanye Sadvirha Sharanagati. So the Sharanagati, full surrender. The six divisions of surrender are the acceptance of things favorable to devotional service, rejection of unfavorable things, the conviction that Krishna will give protection, the acceptance of the Lord as one's guardian or master, and full self-surrender, complete dependence on the Lord, and humility. So these are the symptoms of surrender, and these are obviously qualities that we would want to obtain to reach this surrendered position. But I thought the one that has kind of stood out to me of this is the conviction that Krishna will give all protection. So that's a very, very important aspect of a devotee's life. This idea that we are completely under Krishna's shelter, under his protection, and we have that conviction that Krishna will give us that protection at all times. In the purport to that verse, Srila Prabhupada says, situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's general personal protection. When a living entity is fully surrendered, he is under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization. So this taking shelter of Krishna is extremely important in devotional service. And even in the neophyte position, although we have not obviously manifested fully these six symptoms of surrender, we can, even from the very beginning, begin to learn to take shelter of Krishna. And this is something, of course, I think from our very first days in Krishna consciousness, you know, we always heard and we've talked about and we've tried to practice that when one is in any position of difficulty or any position where one doesn't understand anything fully, that if one simply is able to take shelter of Krishna, then one is able to get through so many situations. In the material world, where do we take shelter? Where is there any place for us to have security? There is none. Even our friends, our family, everyone, of course, they're called fallible soldiers. Other living entities can only help us so much. They can only love us so much. They can only, it's all up to a certain point. And then ultimately, even if one had a perfect relationship throughout one's entire life, at the time of death comes, and that person will leave us at the time of death. So ultimately, we understand that the only person who will always be with us is Krishna and, of course, the spiritual master. That is the one person that we can depend upon, not just in this lifetime, but eternally. So when we surrender to Krishna, acting under the order of the spiritual master, our life is changed. There is a significant qualitative difference in the life of a devotee compared to the life of a non-devotee. We often say that we are under the spiritual energy, under the influence of the internal potency. Well, what does that mean? That means that we are no longer working under the influence of ordinary karma. For the non-devotee, life is a matter of action and reaction. One performs pious activities, one gains a good reaction, one performs sinful activities, and there is a negative reaction. And this carries on life after life as we transmigrate through the different species of life. It is somewhat different for the devotee. The devotee is under Krishna's care directly. Yes, we may experience some residual reaction to past sinful activities. And, of course, Prabhupada gives an example of the fan winding down. The fan is going, you pull the plug on the fan, and there's maybe still some residual action of karma, just as it takes a while for the fan to come to a complete stop. So in the same way, we may still experience that. But it's very, very different for the devotee. For the materialist, material life is a constant source of fear, of anxiety, of suffering and pain. For the devotee, it's very different, because when we do take shelter of Krishna, we understand that everything is under Krishna's direction. Everything that happens to us is directly under Krishna's guidance, and we simply need to have that faith that Krishna is there working for us in all circumstances. We can see the example that Prabhupada gives us of a mother cat. The mother cat, when she wants to carry the baby cat, the kitten around, picks it up by the back of the neck. We'll take it from one place to the other. The kitten feels very secure. The kitten knows this is my mother, and she is helping me, taking me somewhere where I need to be. But the cat also will have the rat in the grips of its teeth. And for the rat, it's a very different experience. For the rat, it's certain death. So the rat is experiencing the same thing, being in the grips of the teeth of the cat as death. The kitten is experiencing, and this, of course, is being in the grips of this material world, but under the shelter of Krishna, the devotee is experiencing Krishna's loving protection at every moment, Krishna's guidance at every moment, and Krishna giving us those things which are necessary for advancing in Krishna consciousness. So Krishna often gives us protection. Krishna gives us shelter, and even if we don't ask, sometimes we don't even necessarily have to ask, for Krishna. Sometimes people ask about prayer. Do we need to? The devotees don't necessarily pray in the same way that a non-devotee or materialistic person would, that we don't pray necessarily for, can I have a new car? Can I get a better job? Can I get this? Can I get that? But we do pray for Krishna. We pray to have the shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. We pray for his guidance, for his protection, that we may always remember him in every circumstance. Those things we do pray for. We do pray that we have that connection, that relationship, and that loving relationship of service will always be with us. So Krishna in his kindness is always helping us in Krishna consciousness and always trying to help us to advance in Krishna consciousness, sometimes even more than we want to ourselves. It's stated that we take one step towards Krishna, Krishna will take two steps towards us. So even if we are not always so inclined towards Krishna consciousness, we may have many difficulties with material desires. We have so many anartas that we bring from this lifetime and from past lifetimes. Nevertheless, Krishna sees a little bit of sincerity in the heart of the devotee. He appreciates that little bit of devotional service. And of course, also, we know that due to the mercy of the spiritual master is recommending us to Krishna. So in so many ways, Krishna takes great mercy upon the living entity who is trying to surrender, who has finally turned away from this material illusion and this entanglement with all of the sensory activities of material life. Say, now I am trying to serve you, Krishna. So Krishna, knowing the difficulties and the struggles, still tries to help the devotee. So some very wonderful verses in the Madhya Lila 22. This is verses 39 through 42, where Krishna talks about his relationship with the devotees and how he tries to help us in Krishna consciousness. Krishna says, if one engages in my transcendental loving service, but at the same time, wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he is very, very foolish. Indeed, he is just like a person who gives up ambrosia to drink poison. Since I am very intelligent, why should I give this fool material prosperity? Instead, I shall induce him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material enjoyment. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so. But he does not award anything which, after being enjoyed, will cause one to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. When one has other desires but engages in the Lord's service, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where one will forget all other desires. When someone engages in Lord Krishna's devotional service for the satisfaction of the senses and instead acquires a taste for serving Krishna, he gives up material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. So there's several verses throughout our scriptures that I find particularly reassuring and give us great hope. I think this is one of the series of verses where Krishna tells us directly, more or less, we're seeing sort of from his perspective. Lord Chaitanya is describing how Krishna is viewing the living entity who is trying to perform devotional service. So he says, if one engages in devotional service but at the same time has material desires, that may apply to a few of us, Krishna understands that. And he says, why should I give that person material opulence if it's going to take him away from his real goal of Krishna consciousness? So in other words, by chanting Hare Krishna, by saying, so many thousands of times a day, O Krishna, O Radharani, please engage me in your service. You know, we're saying that how many times? 25,000 times a day or whatever, 25,000 word mantras. We're saying, Krishna, O Radharani, please engage me in your service. So Krishna is hearing that. and saying, all right, I will engage you in my service. So then if we say, but I really don't want to engage in service, I kind of want something else, Krishna's saying, but you've been asking me day after day after day to engage me in your service. So we can only blame ourselves that Krishna will not always award us those material things that we want. And for our good and for our ultimate happiness and for our satisfaction in developing and relishing our loving relationship of devotional service with Krishna, Krishna will sometimes take those things away from us or not award those things if they are not helpful in our Krishna consciousness. So, as we're stating the science of surrender earlier, we're to accept those things favorable to Krishna consciousness, reject those things unfavorable. If we don't have good intelligence always to know what to accept and what to reject, Krishna will help us in that process, he's saying. He will help us to know what we should accept and what we should reject. So, Krishna does not want to award us material things that will cause us to become more entangled in material life and less surrendered to him. Therefore, he says Krishna will forcibly give one shelter at his lotus feet where one will forget all other desires. Now, the interesting thing about that, it's not that he is forcing us to give up material desires. He is forcing us to take shelter at his lotus feet and then we give up the material desires. Krishna consciousness is a voluntary process. The living entity has free will, minute free will. We can't do anything and be anything, but we do have that free will to choose. To serve Krishna, to love Krishna, or not to serve Krishna and love Krishna is always our choice. So Krishna gives us that choice, but what he does is he sets up the situation so the choice becomes a little easier for us, becomes a little bit more obvious. So he gives us shelter as lotus feet, and then naturally, he says, we forget all of the desires. So Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada always presented as a positive program. By experiencing the pleasure of chanting Hare Krishna, of serving Krishna, then the material activities and material desires become diminished. They become less important to us. So engaging fully in Krishna consciousness, you know, keeps the mind very, very strictly involved in the processes of Krishna consciousness, and then there's less room for other desires, and we're able to give those things up. It says he gives up his material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. So, yes, Krishna sets this up for the devotee. Krishna's in control of our devotional life. He's in control of everything, you know. But he gives us a situation that we can willingly offer ourselves as an eternal servant of Krishna, and which is really the definition of what we've been talking about, taking shelter of the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna. So Krishna works in so many ways to help us to develop this, as we see that he's always working in our best interest, even if we don't see that. And we don't always. Sometimes we don't understand how and why Krishna is working. But the faith that we develop in Krishna consciousness is the faith to know that Krishna is always, whatever is happening to us, is in our best interest, that Krishna is working for our ultimate happiness, our spiritual happiness, even if materially it may not seem so at the moment. So part of our advancement in Krishna consciousness as we progress through the years as devotees is that, first of all, we develop this faith. Our faith becomes stronger, that we understand that Krishna is working for us and that whatever happens is ultimately up to Krishna and is not under our control and that there is a reason for it. And also we begin to try to see how Krishna is dealing with us. If a particular situation causes us difficulty and the devotee's attitude is, you know, Krishna has somehow or another arranged this situation for me, what is my lesson? And sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's difficult in the immediate moment to see what the lesson is. Sometimes it's later. Sometimes weeks, months, or years later that we can understand how a situation was really best for us or how it was an opportunity for us to surrender. Now, we may or may not have taken the opportunity properly either. The opportunity may be there that Krishna is presenting. Here's an opportunity to advance in Krishna consciousness. Now, it's also said that Krishna doesn't give us tests beyond which we are able to meet. You know, Krishna will not give us too much. You know, sometimes we think it may be too much, but it isn't because it's what Krishna is presenting to us. So it may be a difficult test, but nevertheless, it is a test, or we should actually not see it so much as a test, but as an opportunity. And even if it's something that is very difficult, that gives us even more opportunity to surrender and to take shelter of Krishna. And often it forces us to take shelter of Krishna, because the thing is, a devotee realizes very quickly, what's the alternative? You know, what else can you think about? I mean, what are you going to do? I remember I had surgery about 6 years ago, and actually that was a great opportunity for me to remember Krishna and to take shelter of Krishna. And I was thinking just before surgery that they were, what else can you do? You're faced a difficult situation. You know, who could you rely on? Say, oh, my dear doctor, I surrender at your lotus feet. You know, please, you know, may I be successful in this? No, I mean, the doctor's fallible. He's doing his best. Hopefully he's a good doctor. He has some skill, but, you know, it's not up to him. You know, he's limited in his capacities and his knowledge. And ultimately, you know, as we know, people live or die. And, it's up to Krishna. Sometimes people miraculously recovered when the doctors say they have no chance. And sometimes a person seems quite healthy and then there's some sudden reversal. So I remember the time when I was going under, you know, with the, I don't know, I was going to say ether. That shows how old I am. They haven't used that for about 100 years, I don't think. But, you know, whatever the anesthesia, you know, the anesthetic, you know, that puts you under. And I was trying to just think of the lotus feet of Radha Shamasundar, our deities in Alachua. And then when it came out, that was more or less what I was remembering. And it was kind of like, it sort of like was just like clicked back on and remembering again. And I was very fortunate because I usually don't remember Krishna's lotus feet, you know, very rarely in my life, but Krishna was very kind and said he arranges in such a way that even if we are not so careful to always remember him, he forces himself into our mind. And in those times of difficulty and struggle, Krishna does often force his way into the mind of devotees. And that's his great kindness to us. He helps us to advance in Krishna consciousness. Sometimes there are times of struggle, but he gives us the strength and the ability to go through those times if we simply surrender unto him and take shelter of Krishna, you know, and surrender in that way. How long does class go?
8:30.
Okay. It's probably a good time to wind up. I have some questions. Prajapati Prabhu.
Yes, in this connection, we hear Lord Chaitanya, who is Krishna himself, praying to be made one of the atoms at Krishna's lotus feet.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that, please?
Oh, that's a hard one. Atoms, what does that mean? That seems like that's even lower than a speck of dust, right? Because there are many, many thousands and millions of atoms within each speck of dust. So I would say that is a example of extreme humility. Lord Chaitanya playing the role of the perfect devotee in the mood of the devotee, not only just wants to be dust, but a atom, even smaller than a speck of dust. And again, that's his example for us to, you know, take shelter completely of Krishna. So I think when I think of these lotus feet and think of the dust at the lotus feet or the atoms at the lotus feet of Krishna, you know, I think we can always think about taking shelter of surrender of service. Those things are really synonymous with this idea of taking shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out. Wonderful prayer by Lord Chaitanya. Mantrini, and then...
Why don't you tell the Lord Nrisingadev story?
Oh, okay. That would be appropriate. I'll tell that one. Well, Sachari, would you have a question first?
Oh, I want to hear the story first.
Oh, okay. Well, this is actually a pretty good illustration of it. People have heard this, haven't they? Okay. All right. This is many years ago, back in the 70s or something, or 80s. I don't know. I was in the Potomac Temple in Washington, and I was out on Sankirtan. I was in a parking lot at Christmas time distributing books or whatever we were distributing, some paraphernalia probably, along with the books, whatever we were doing, and collecting money. And this guy comes up to me, kind of a little bit rough-looking, grubby type of young man, not the most savory-looking character, but he starts talking to me, and I'm giving hit my line. He says, well, I've got a bunch of stuff I can give you, you know, for your organization. I say, well, okay. You know, we always accept anything in devotional services. It's out in my car. Why don't you follow me? So I'm following through the parking lot to his car and following. And pretty soon we're way out on the very edge of the parking lot, away from everybody. And I'm kind of this time beginning to wonder if something's wrong with this picture. I really began to wonder when he pulls a gun out. And he basically sticks it right here and says, give me your money. Well, I thought that time probably best to comply. And so, you know, I had about $30 or $40, you know, and I gave it to him. And then he says, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to shoot you. And he pulls the trigger. And the gun goes click. At that moment, that happened so fast that I have to say I did not have time to chant Hare Krishna, to think of Krishna, whatever. But immediately, my entire consciousness was filled with the sort of the visualization and the of Lord Nrisimhadev. And I started chanting Tavakara Kamala. I mean, and that time I could realize that Lord Nrisimhadev had directly protected me at the time, and he had forced himself in my mind. I'd like to say, oh, I immediately thought of Krishna. No, I didn't. It was too quick. It was too, you know, sudden. But Krishna forced himself in my mind, and that's what we're talking about here, this greatness of Krishna, of how he protects his devotee. And so, obviously, and then, well, to finish the story, he became a little bit bewildered and kind of looked at the gun and wasn't quite sure what was happening. And so I just started talking really fast. You know, I just... I said, you know, God just saved me at that moment. And I started talking to him and telling him what we're doing and about Krishna consciousness. And he starts listening. And he's listening. And I'm telling him about Krishna consciousness. And, you know, and I give him a Sunday feast card, invite him to the Sunday feast. He says, you come. And then it's, you know, and then after, you know, he was pretty calmed down and everything, this was just some kind of curiosity I had. I just had to know. I said, was that gun really loaded? And he says, sure was. And he pulls out the cartridge full of bullets, and he said, it sure worked, and the guy blew away last night. Oh. You know, and it's like, so, again, I mean, it was absolutely confirmed that this was directly being saved by Krishna, you know. Of course, then I tried to push my luck a little. I said, one more thing, you know, for our work, we could really use that money. Do you think you could give it back? I was on a roll then, you know. Anyway, then his partner drives up in this little car and says, come on, we got to get out of here. So I didn't get it back. He took off, you know. And he didn't come to Sunday feast, surprisingly enough. I was looking for him. But, you know, it's an interesting story. But to me, what was so significant was, first of all, of course, of realizing Krishna's protection. And that, Lord, you know, I certainly have been a great bhakta of Lord Nrisimhadev from that moment on in my life. And but understanding how Krishna takes care of us in all circumstances. And again, how he would force himself into our mind, you know, regardless of the situation that we were in. So that's that story. Okay. Mother Sochari, you had a question?
Well, before my question, I wanted to add to the story. There's actually more to the story. Because I was living with Tamaharan Montrini at this time.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And so so Montrini said to me, Sucharya, come downstairs quick. So apparently her husband had called, and he said, I've just been shot. And the gun didn't go off. And Montrini was just like, you know, she had a four-month-old baby. Your youngest daughter was 4 months in your... Oh, you were pregnant? Oh,
no, okay. She was still pregnant, I think.
She was pregnant. Well, yeah. She had kids at home. And so then she said, well, come right home. And he said, well, no, I have to go out and collect all the money that I lost.
So Montrini, you have to get your priorities straight.
So Montrini cooked a feast at home, and she was like, her eyes were really big, and she said, my husband almost died. So Krishna saved them. I just had a quick question about in the purport. It's quoted by Srila Vishnu Chakravarti that great personalities like the goddess Rama, the wife of Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma are not at all sinful. So these personalities are not sinful, so the people that are associating with them are also not sinful, because it's the sinful desires and sinful activities that keep us from going, becoming pure devotees and going back to Godhead. So these personalities are basically in the spiritual world, but they're living in the material world. Is that the idea?
Well, they're great personalities. They're pure devotees. They said their heads were Sampradaya. Obviously, all the associates of Lord Shiva are not necessarily pure devotees. So they may have different followers in different stages. Lord Shiva, has his own planet, doesn't he? Which is considered a spiritual planet, but it's, you know, it's kind of this one in between. Everything about Lord Shiva is a little bit different. You know, he's kind of in between everything. You know, it's the example of the, you know, yogurt and milk transformation. It's not exactly milk. It's not exactly, but it isn't. But it's like milk. So Lord Shiva, you know, has his own abode. Of course, Brahma is a position. We have to remember, Lord Brahma is the position of the head of this material universe. There are many Lord Brahmas. The particular Lord Brahma now, of course, is the head of our Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, and so of course the followers of their sampradayas, there are many, many pure devotees in those lines. So as far as being in the spiritual world, my understanding is that at the end of the cosmic annihilation, Lord Brahma and the residents of Brahmaloka all go back to the spiritual world. So, yeah, you could say they're in the spiritual world in the sense that they're pure devotees and they're, I mean, with, you know, sometimes I think we minimize the position, we say, oh, the demigods, this and that. Well, you know, when Lord Brahma comes to Vrindavan, the material world, and gets to take darshan of Krishna, or even when Indra comes and gets to take darshan of Krishna, this is very, very special. These are very, very elevated positions. You know, in other words, even to be in a situation where you're chastised by Krishna and you come before him, I mean, who can imagine, you know, how elevated these personalities are to have that kind of direct darshan of Krishna. So, yeah, they... and the other understanding, just as you mentioned it, is, of course, the demigods were asked to come down, you know, and take birth when Krishna appeared in this. So we can understand, you know, and, you know, Goloka Vrindavan is, you know, non different than Gokula. So, yeah, I guess you'd say they're both in the spiritual material world. I don't know if anyone has any better technical answer there. Anything else? Over here. We have Don Kele or up here, whatever.
Thank you so much for this wonderful class. It's really a pleasure hearing from you.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. My question has to do with an example of a group of a couple of Sankirtan devotees and they're come back to the temple and they have collected about $3,500. And they left it in their Sankirtan van. And then someone broke into the van and stole the money. So they came before Srila Prabhupada and, you know, they were supposed to have taken the collection and put it in the safe at night before they went to sleep, but they didn't do that. They left it in the van. Someone broke in the van. But when it was brought to Srila Prabhupada's attention, Prabhupada said that they said, everything is Krishna's arrangement. Everything's going on by Krishna's arrangement, so just take it as Krishna's arrangement. Prabhupada said, no, it is not Krishna's arrangement. That is Maya. So see, in your class, you have this underlying theme of everything is Krishna's arrangement, and we should just take things as Krishna's arrangement, no matter what is happening to us. But this is a situation here where Prabhupada's saying it's not Krishna's arrangement. There are things that are not Krishna's arrangement also. There are things that are Maya's arrangement. So I was wondering how you could fit that component into the class. And there's a further part of it that is coming to my mind just so I can get it out, is that sometimes we have this idea that Krishna will not give us anything that will stop us in devotional service. But we see some devotees struggling with illicit sex, so, you know, and there's like an arrangement for their illicit sex, or they're struggling with drugs, or they're struggling with alcohol, and these things are being provided to them. Seemingly, you know, it's like an arrangement for them to constantly be facilitated in a way that's not advantageous at all to their spiritual development. So how are we supposed to see these things as Krishna's everything as Krishna's?
Well, that's a very good point you made. And there's I can think of other examples, too, where Srila Prabhupada made similar comments. You know, if a devotee made a mistake, and mess something up for the deity, say, oh, Krishna's arrangement and Krishna's mercy or something, Prabhupada would get angry about that and say, no, it's your foolishness or your mistake. So we don't use Krishna as our excuse. you know, to do things poorly, to do things sloppily, to do things that are actually not in Krishna conscious. In other words, if we're being very Krishna conscious, if we're 100% Krishna conscious, we could actually say everything is Krishna's arrangement. I mean, we wouldn't deny that everything in Srila Prabhupada's life, right, is Krishna's arrangement, because he's a purely surrendered devotee to Krishna, so whatever happens, and Prabhupada would always understand it that way too. And things, negative things happen to Srila Prabhupada. He was gored by a bull, he was, got, you know, had heart attacks, but it's like he never lost faith in Krishna. You know, never lost faith that, you know, that Krishna wasn't arranging and guiding everything. I guess another way of looking at it is we also have to remember, and Srila Prabhupada pointed this out, we're also in the material world. We are in this material world. We do have these material bodies and minds, and therefore the force and the actions of Maya, of the material nature, is there. That is a fact. And so we are also sort of struggling between these worlds of material energy and the spiritual energy. And, of course, we are the living entity is Tatashta Shakti. We are marginal energy, right? And Prabhupada gives the example of, it's like, you know, it's like the line of demarcation between, you know, at the beach where the water meets it. Sometimes the water recedes and sometimes the water comes up. And, right, you know, so sometimes it's land, sometimes it's water. So we're like that. We can be under the material energy or under the spiritual energy. I think that Srila Prabhupada was trying to point out to those Sangatan devotees that by not doing what they were supposed to be doing, and why didn't they? Maybe they were eager to go to Prasadam or whatever it might have been. Who knows what it might have been? Something maybe very innocent, you know. But still, somehow or another, there was some influence of material energy. And so Srila Prabhupada was trying to point out that, you know, if we are acting under the modes of nature, under any kind of material energy other than directly, you know, Krishna and the spiritual master's directions, we shouldn't use that as an excuse. Now, the living entity has free will, as we pointed out before, and Krishna does fulfill the desires of all living entities, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, whatever our desire is, you know, those can be fulfilled. But, of course, they're fulfilled at a price, or there is a reaction. Whatever those desires are and the manifestation of those may have a negative reaction. Krishna may allow us to experience those negative reactions, you know, for certain reasons. I think what we have to see is that the big picture, that Krishna is arranging our lives in this large picture of coming to Krishna consciousness, of surrendering to him. That doesn't mean that we use every moment, every incident, if we make a mistake, that's an excuse, it's Krishna's arrangement. But what we can see is that Krishna has made the arrangements in our life, and within those arrangements, we have choices, right? As I said, we have the choice whether to surrender to the situation or not. So if we don't, you know, Krishna gives us the opportunity, but if we don't accept that opportunity and we make choices, you know, towards the material energy, towards Maya, then what can he do? Krishna, okay. All right, Esprit.
Thank you very much for a wonderful class. In the beginning of the class, there was a mentioning that in the material world, one of the most degraded things is sex life. And the spiritual world, it's the most elevated. And I was just reading in the Chaitanya Charitamrita introduction where Prabhupada says, in the spiritual world, there is no sex life. And I've heard Prabhupada in another part, he mentioned, to give evidence of this, he said, none of the gopis are getting pregnant by Krishna. To give evidence that there's no sex life.
Well, it's been stated different ways, different times. Obviously, we have the Madhurya Rasa, and it's, you know, it is compared to the loving relationships between men and women. But Prabhupada always makes it very clear the difference between material and spiritual, and that we should not compare the spiritual activities of Krishna and the gopis with mundane material sex life. Yes. So we want to make a clear distinction in our mind, but that's part of the reason, because it is so opposite. In other words, one can't make a direct comparison because it's a very, very elevated, it's a very, very elevated relationship of the highest mood of love and service that predominates in the relationship of Krishna and the gopis, rather than desire for one's personal sense, sensual gratification, which characterizes activity in the material world. So in that sense, it's completely different, yeah, because one is directed completely in loving service, you know, towards the beloved, and not so much that way in the material world. You know. But Prabhupada says it differently in different places, you know. I think in the when he says there is no sex, in other words, there's obviously a relationship which we might see is in a similar, is in this rasa, but Prabhupada will say that to clearly distinguish how different it is from what we experience in the material world. Did you, Nikhili, anything?
The purport, it also mentions how although Brahma and Shiva aren't sinful, they still feel them. It's, I think it said, in the bliss of Krishna consciousness, they feel themselves to be genuinely fallen.
Mm-hmm.
And when we sing bhajans and we like the writings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and all the acharyas, and Srila Prabhupada also in his marquee Bhagavad Dharma when he first came over, they're expressing these emotions of deep humility, yeah, and they genuinely feel themselves very, yeah, fallen and low, and they say, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, how he's just completely absorbed in family life and all these things. And for someone who doesn't have, who's not Krishna conscious, it would be easy for us to, for me to compare myself to him and say, well, you know, he's given due as being a pure devotee, but actually he himself is saying that he's a materialist. So it's, yeah, it would be easy for someone to become confused like that.
Well, in the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Narottam and the great acharyas, they often put themselves in the position of the ordinary conditioned soul. And in Bhaktivinoda's what is it, the Manashiksha, when he talks about his mind, that, yeah, he's not, this isn't his actual thoughts, but he is giving the thoughts, you know, of the materialistic person. So the pure devotees are taking that role for our benefit, and so that we can understand that in one sense. But they are also feeling genuinely humble. You know, the sense of humility, of being very low in comparison to the Supreme Personality of God, it is also there. It's described that one on the Uttama Adhikari stage sees everyone as serving Krishna except themselves. You know, I'm not serving so well. I'm very lowly. Everyone else has their position, has their role. Everyone is serving Krishna in some way except for me. That's the natural position of the devotee. So, you know, yes, it's natural. Yes, they do feel a sense of humility, but they often will express themselves, you know, for the benefit of the conditioned souls and songs like that that you mentioned about the Bhaktivinodes. Yeah. Do you have any more thoughts on it or anything you wanted to add? No. Yeah. Okay, maybe one more and we should probably end. Or go ahead.
I was just curious about I believe it's in the Chaitanya, in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Anyway, the concept that Lord Chaitanya taught, dasa anudas, mm-hmm, servant of the servant of the servant, and the further removed, the sweeter.
Yeah. Yeah, the mood of service predominates in pure devotional service. As one becomes more advanced in Krishna consciousness, one becomes more and more eager to serve, more and more relishes that mood of service. And as one achieves humility and achieves the mood of service, then one sees that one doesn't necessarily just serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead directly, but serves the servants of Krishna. And, of course, it begins with the spiritual master, but also then one sees, well, I should also serve the servants of my spiritual master, and I should serve their servants. So, yes, as one's, and this is, of course, one of the signs of spiritual advancement, is this development of this humility and service attitude. And it's an increasingly deepening of the attitude and the mood of service to understand that. Because actually, when you think about, if you think, well, I just serve Prabhupada directly, or I just serve Krishna, I don't, you know, that's you know, there's a little bit arrogant. There's a little lack of humility there. But if I'm very willing to serve the all the devotees, all the Vaishnavas, well, then that's true humility. And that's something that we do want to cultivate. And as you pointed out, it was given to us by the Lord himself in his appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that mood of das, anadas, anadas. Yeah, thank you. Okay, one more, then William.
Hare Krishna. So, this is just one conversation with Prabhupada and Harisari. And he mentions that Krishna can't be impotent. And he gives... I see. That with the dancing, like with the Rasa Lila, he said, you go... Let me see, I lost my spot. Sorry. See, I haven't read all the like Rasa Lila pastimes of, you know, esoteric books, which might speak about these things in detail. But Prabhupada said, no, apart from that, if Krishna danced with so many thousands of gopis, he had so many wives. So why were there pregnancy? The gopis were not pregnant. He said the gopis had any children by Krishna, and no children by Krishna, but his wives had 10 children each. You cannot say that he was impotent. Therefore, he could not make the gopis pregnant. You cannot say. Because when he was married, he begot 10 children, each and every wife.
That would indicate some type of what we think of as sexual life of some spiritual transcendental. But, you know, I honestly don't really think about these things a whole lot or try to get too deeply into them because it's way beyond my understanding, to be honest. Mm. And I feel as far as the details of Krishna's relationships with the gopis and with his queens, like, you know, I think we just take what we read in scripture and Krishna book and 10th canto kind of at face value. And know that eventually as we become advanced in Krishna consciousness, more and more will be revealed. At least I think in some lifetime maybe I'll understand all these things. But... You know, it's. I think we get the general idea, the general idea of Krishna and his different rasas and his relationships. And the main idea that I think that Prabhupada gives us over and over again is don't think of these as mundane relationships. Understand that these are very, very elevated, the most elevated, you know, spiritual rasas. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Srila Prabhupada. Jai Radhakala Janji.